Okay, so this is care. And the reason this meeting, well, what happens at the British Animal Studies Network meetings, for those of you who don't know, is that the attempt is always to get people from totally different disciplines, different professions, we've got NGOs as well as academics here, to come and think out loud about a particular big idea. And care was suggested to me as a topic by this gentleman here, who I'll introduce more fully in a second, because this is the bicentenary of the Martins Act, which was the first ever piece of animal legislation. I'm not going to say any more about it because I believe...
Yeah, it's my talk.
Your talk. Already it's gone horribly wrong. Yeah. The grumpy vegan hits the floor running. So it just seemed like a very appropriate topic to have. We've had a series of three online events about care and aesthetics, care and wild animals, and care for horses. They are all available for you to watch on YouTube by the British Animal Studies Network webpage. I said to Deb just now, I realised as I was walking up, remembering things like biscuits and the important things. I hadn't written my introduction for today, so it was going to be 10 minutes, and it's not going to be 10 minutes. Two things to say briefly is, it's great to have everybody back. Thank you for risking public transport or whatever journeys you've made. I really appreciate it. The network is a network because it always has the intention of getting people in a room to have a chat. I always think the papers are the excuse to get us in the room to have a conversation, not that the papers aren't important and fantastic and all the rest of it. This is the 10th anniversary of our meetings at Strathclyde. Obviously we've missed a year because of COVID, the first lockdown. We then did it online last year, but we started here in 2012 with Wild, where we had Tim Ingold as one of our speakers. But the network proper began 15 years ago in London, when I had 2 years worth of funding from the AHRC to have 10 meetings. And if you look on the British Animal Studies Network website, there's a list of the talks that were there. And it's kind of extraordinary, the names of the people who've written the books that we've all read. And Donna Haraway. I always had it as my final talk has to be Donna Haraway. There's just no other thing. And she said yes, and my proud moment was I met her at Heathrow Airport holding the Companion Species Manifesto, so she'd know it was me. So anyway, it's fantastic that we keep going. I think animal studies has grown exponentially since we started, and more we are going to conferences within our own fields, to the extent that I can now go to early modern animal conferences, not even just history or literary studies, but early modern studies. But I still think it is so important for us to kind of talk across disciplines and across expertise. My own experience of that has been that it's fundamental. So at one of the meetings in 2008, sorry, I'm going to go on a bit now, I've suddenly got 10 minutes worth of stuff to say. Mara Mila, who is a very important human animal geographer, invited me to give a talk at a welfare quality conference, which was about EC welfare standards for animals in agriculture. And I said, well, what do you want me to talk about? And she said, the past. And I was kind of thinking, and she said, it's in Florence. I'll come. And it was one of those conferences that changed everything. To hear people talking about things like how you can look at a sheep's ears and work out if it's tense or happy. And sitting there thinking, they would have known this in the 17th century. How do I find that? How would I track that? That became a book that I wrote. And I also met Françoise Wemmelsfelder, who's an animal welfare scientist there, whose work has been really informed the historical work I've done. So I genuinely believe that this is has incredibly productive possibilities. So please, if there's somebody you want to talk to who you've not talked to yet and you're too embarrassed to introduce yourself, talk to me. Where's Ali and Nicole and Ben? They are, I don't want to say the word slave, let's call them postgrad. But anyway, and me, we will introduce you, but please feel free to go and talk to people, that's the point. I'm going to stop there. I am now going to introduce our opening plenary speaker. I'm walking behind because I left my notes on this side. So this is Kim Stallwood. Many of you will know him from conferences, from meetings, but Kim, I'm not going to read out the big biographies of everybody as we go through because that takes time. The thing we need to know about Kim, among many other things, is he was the first executive director of PETA, and he was the co-founder of the Animals and Society Institute. So he is doing really important work on every possible level. And it's fantastic to have you here, Kim, so I'll hand over to you.
Erica, thank you very much. And I want to salute Erica for the work she's done in helping to advance human-animal studies, and express everything, my appreciation for everything that I've learned from her, from reading her books, and conversations with her in the past, and hopefully the present and the future. I want to make sure that I got the technology organized. This is where the speaker always has a moment of panic.
Just click forward.
There you go. It works. Okay. So my name is Kim Stallwood. I work as an independent consultant with client organizations, animal groups, and some individuals. And I'm also an author and working on various projects. And I also work on projects related to the history, preserving the history of the animal rights movement. I have a collection in the British Library, and I'm working with a Swiss group called Tierum Recht on other material that I've collected over the years that is going there. But the focus of today is the Martins Act, the bicentenary of the Martins Act. And I hope you find this interesting. How many of you are aware or have heard of Richard Martin and the Martins Act? Okay, so that's about maybe a fifth of you, something like that. Well, I hope you find this interesting, and the history of the movement is very important, because how can we know where we're going to go in the future if we don't know our past? And this is the bicentenary of the 1822 Martins Act, and this is, well, I'll explain why this is important. So it's often said that Britain is a nation of animal lovers, putting aside any debate about the terminology of animal lovers, but it's often said that Britain is a nation of animal lovers. A good way to open up a talk, hopefully. Two of the foundations on which this claim rests are celebrated in two imminent and interconnected bicentenaries. The first is this year's bicentenary of the 1822 Act to prevent the cruel and improper treatment of cattle, passed by the British Parliament. The Act is generally recognised as the first piece of animal welfare legislation passed by a modern representative political body. It is sometimes referred to as the Cruel Treatment of Cattle Act, but it is more usually known simply as Martin's Act. It is named after the Irishman Richard Martin, the MP for Galway, who led the campaign for its passage. Martin is also a key figure in the second bicentenary. This is the founding of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in 1824. Martin attended a meeting of prominent humanitarians at Old Slaughter's Coffee House in London that led to the establishment of the SPCA. The SPCA received its royal patronage from Queen Victoria in 1840, thereby becoming the RSPCA, which is the society I'm sure you're all familiar with today. As significant as these two bicentenaries are, the Martins Act this year and the RSPCA's founding in 2 years, it is also important to recognise other key moments in the history of human-animal relations, to understand them not as isolated events, but as a series of developments over thousands of years. While Martin's Act is the first animal welfare legislation passed by a modern representative government, the Massachusetts General Court established its bodies of liberties in 1641. They contained regulations against tyranny or cruelty toward domestic animals. Passage 92 reads, "No man shall exercise any tyranny or cruelty toward any brute creature which are usually kept for man's use." Also, more than 2,000 years ago, the Indian Emperor Ashoka promoted the spread of Buddhism in the Indian subcontinent with a series of edicts carved into rock and stone pillars. They include animal protection proclamations that no living beings are to be slaughtered or offered in sacrifice. While the Massachusetts Body of Liberties and Ashoka's edicts were not passed by representative political bodies, as we understand them today, they recognize the treatment of animals as an important issue of governance and public policy. While the SPCA, later the RSPCA, is recognized as the oldest national animal protection organization in the world, it is not the first of its kind to be established. the Society for the Suppression and Prevention of Wanton Cruelty to Animals was founded at the Crown and Anchor on Bold Street in Liverpool in 1809. The RSPCA Liverpool branch considers this society to be probably the oldest animal charity in the world. Turner noted in his 1965 book on the history of human-animal relations, All Heaven in a Rage, which I highly recommend, that the society stated that it hoped to operate by the exercise of coercion, the boycott of cruel tradesmen, by inserting accounts of cruelty in newspapers, and by the diffusion of such principles and feelings as shall be incompatible with the existence of the spirit whence cruelty to animals originates. I'm not going to read the other bullet there, but you can see it. And what struck me was how much that described what we currently do today. Really, the tactics and strategies in 200 years have not changed that much. They've changed because the times have changed, but fundamentally they are the same. So rewrite this paragraph to be in keeping with today's writing styles, and it will not be that different from what contemporary animal rights organisations state in their strategic plans. The strategy of the animal protection movement has developed over the last 200 years and adapted to different times and circumstances, but it is essentially unchanged in what it does. The Liverpool Advertiser and Marine Intelligence newspaper contains notices of the Society's first two meetings. This is the one that I'm referring to that was formed in 1809. And the Liverpool RSPCA Liverpool branch notes on its website that it had to manage the response from animal abusers to their investigations into how they use animals. This is the second bullet here. So they had to hide themselves because the people who they were criticizing, who were abusing animals, were attacking them essentially. Not dissimilar activities happen to some extent with hunt saboteurs every weekend that they go out. So consequently, the activities of the society, this is the 1804 one, and its history are sadly unknown. Not much is known about this first original organisation. And it wasn't until 1834 that the Liverpool Anti-Cruelty Society reasserted its existence with an advertisement in the Liverpool Mercury that announced its formation. But the society struggled and eventually became the Liverpool branch of the RSPCA in the 1840s. So while wanting to acknowledge that these key developments in human-animal relations and others I do not have time to consider here, my presentation focuses on the Martins Act and the RSPCA's founding, and on Richard Martin, who was a key player in both. And I'm going to conclude with some brief thoughts about how our successors may celebrate the quadricentenary of the Martins Act 200 years from now, in 2222, and the foundation of the RSPCA in 2224. So, Richard Martin, a really fascinating figure. So Richard Martin was born into a land-owning family. How do I say this word? Bally and Hinch Castle? Any help here? Anyone know? All right, well, you can read it. That's how I say it. Bally in a Hinch Castle. This is in Connemara, County Galway. So this is where he's born in February 1754. The exact date of his birth is unknown. The family estate consisted of 200,000 acres. Turner, in the book, or Heaven in a Rage, he notes that from the door of his castle at Bally in Hinch, he, Martin, could drive 30 miles before he reached the gatehouse. It was that big. So Martin's family was land rich and cash poor. And in a 1925 biography of Martin that was written by Wellesley Payne, that's very good, it says that Martin's financial troubles began when he was a young man. He may be said to have inherited them. So he came from wealth, but he didn't really have wealth to draw from. Which is just as well, because Martin cared little for money or wealth. His final years were spent with his second wife and daughters evading creditors living in exile in Boulogne-sur-Mer, France, where he died in 1834, some days short of his 80th birthday. So Martin went to Harrow, gained admission to Trinity College, Cambridge in 1773, but he did not graduate with a degree. He was admitted to the bar at Lincoln's Inn in 1776 and served as a lawyer in Ireland and became the High Sheriff of Galway in 1782. He was elected to the Irish House of Commons in 1776, and the Act of Union in 1800 dissolved the Irish Parliament and obliged Irish MPs to sit in the UK Parliament in London. He represented Galway County in Westminster until he left Parliament in 1826. He lived an eventful life, including as a colonel of the County Galway Volunteers, a survivor of two shipwrecks, and a victor in more than 100 duels with swords and pistols. For someone like Martin, Payne writes in his biography of him, one might have been surprised if Martin had not been a duelist. Apparently, eminent statesmen and successful lawyers at this time were experienced duelists. And maybe it's a shame that that practice has passed out with some of the lawyers I've had dealings with. Anyway, he travelled throughout Europe and the Americas during the 1770s, including New England when the American Revolutionary War began. He was active in several causes, including the movement to abolish slavery, the campaign for Catholic emancipation, and the abolition of capital punishment for forgery. Quite a character, as I say. So one of Martin's daughters, by his second marriage, Miss Harriet Martin, writing in 1871, summed up his father's character as follows. Now, I'm not going to read this out, but I hope you can all see it and scan through it, and I'll keep talking. So, unless you were fortunate to be born into an economic class that provided wealth and power, life in Georgia and Britain and Ireland was not easy either for people or animals. Before the development of charity as a way to ameliorate society's problems of injustice and inequality, people who helped others because they felt compassion toward them were considered to be extraordinary. To hold similar concerns for animals made you eccentric. He had a keen sense of humor, Payne wrote in the biography of Martin. Though he preferred people to laugh with him, he did not lose his temper when they laughed at him. Payne suggests Martin's inherent love for animals began when he was a child. Another author who wrote an interesting book, Chivalo, describes how Martin's mother, Bridget, and her sisters filled their houses with dogs, cats, and canaries. But this childhood encouragement to love animals was interrupted by the cruel treatment of horses and farmed animals he witnessed growing up on the family's estate. Martin most likely witnessed the common practice to attach ploughs and harrows to the tails of horses and for live sheep, instead of shearing them, to have their wool pulled off them by hand. Payne also points out that Galway was ahead of its time concerning bullfighting and cockfighting, as both no longer occurred in that county where he was born and raised. This also must have influenced Martin's attitudes towards animals as he grew up. Martin earned two nicknames in his lifetime: Hair Trigger Martin, because of his duels, and Humanity Dick, because of his compassion for animals. Hair Trigger Martin is also applicable to his attitude toward wild animals and birds. He hunted and killed them on his extensive estate in Ireland. I suspect he was trained to hunt and shoot from a young age and was told field sports did not involve cruelty to the animals and birds, as they died quickly and didn't suffer. These so-called field sports were never the target of his anti-cruelty campaigns in Parliament. His focus was on the way the working class made their money and how they enjoyed themselves, never on the pastimes of the upper classes. Martin's class understanding of blood sports and failure to acknowledge them as animal cruelty influenced the RSPCA to ignore hunting and take no action to regulate or end it. Throughout its history, the society's, this is the RSPCA, throughout its history, the society's leadership was dominated by influential and powerful people like Martin, who were blood sports enthusiasts. The RSPCA did not unequivocally oppose hunting until 1976, when its ruling council, led by Richard Ryder and other progressives, embraced animal rights. So Martin had what we consider today to be moral blind spots in his relations with animals. There's nothing to indicate he questioned meat eating or had any interest in becoming a vegetarian. Do Martin's nicknames suggest he cared more for animals than people? Certainly his detractors accused him of this, but Sir John Barrington, a long-standing friend, described Martin's character as urbanity toward women, benevolence toward men, and humanity toward the brute creation. So that's about Richard Martin, so let's now turn to the Martins Act. The first animal welfare bills introduced into Parliament were by Sir William Pulteney in 1800 and John Dent in 1802. Both bills sought to abolish bull baiting. Despite bull baiting becoming increasingly unpopular at that time, the bills were defeated among claims by some MPs and Lords that it was an unfit topic for Parliament. In 1809, Lord Thomas Erskine introduced an anti-cruelty bill in Parliament, which passed the Lords but lost in the Commons. Erskine told the Lords, and this is such a great quote, I am going to read it out. Animals are considered as property only. To destroy or abuse them from malice to the proprietor or with an intention injurious to his interest in them is criminal. But the animals themselves are without protection. The laws regard them not substantively, they have no rights. Now, this could have been written this year, that statement. Martin's first attempt at animal welfare legislation was the Ill Treatment of Cattle Bill, introduced in 1821. He organised both inside and outside Parliament to publicise the need for the bill with activities similar to today's tactics. He worked with sympathetic prominent MPs to arrange for their constituents to sign petitions in support of the bill that was handed into Parliament. Martin understood the need for publicity to highlight the need for a new law. He arrested two men who were cruelly treating a horse on the streets of London. He presented them to magistrates, but they were powerless to do anything as no anti-cruelty law existed to prosecute them under. Martin brought this to the attention of the Times newspaper, which reported on the deficiency of the law and the need for anti-cruelty legislation. The bill secured a win in the Commons by 48 votes to 16, but was lost in the Lords. Again, it was argued animal cruelty was an unfit topic for legislation. So Martin was using parliamentary and extra-parliamentary tactics to get through, or attempt to get through, what he wanted to do in Parliament. Again, not that dissimilar from what happens today. These setbacks did not deter Martin. In 1822, with the active support of Lord Thomas Erskine in the Lords, Martin succeeded in persuading Parliament to pass the Cruel Treatment of Cattle Act, and King George IV gave it royal assent on July 22nd, 1822. Just an aside, there is some argument over the exact date when King George IV did sign the act into law, giving it royal assent, but the date I work by is July 22nd, 1822. And this is where his name, Humanity Dick, the nickname Humanity Dick came from, because the King recognised Martin with the nickname Humanity Dick when he signed it into law. The Act made it an offence for any person or persons, including owners of animals, to wantonly and cruelly beat, abuse, or ill-treat any horse, mare, gelding, mule, ass, ox, cow, heifer, steer, sheep, or other cattle. Provisions in the law allow for animal cruelty complaints to be made on oath to magistrates. Complaints leading to successful convictions required the magistrate to impose fines ranging from a minimum of 10 shillings to a maximum of £5. Complaints determined by a magistrate to be frivolous or vexatious resulted in the complainant being ordered by the magistrate to pay the accused compensation of a maximum of 20 shillings. Between 1822 and when he left Parliament in 1826, Martin made several attempts to amend the 1822 Act or pass new legislation. In 1823, he introduced a bill to prohibit bull baiting and dog fighting. In 1824, he introduced bills to extend the 1822 Act to dogs, cats, and monkeys and other animals, a second attempt to prohibit bear baiting and bullfighting, and a further bill to regulate knacker's yards and the treatment of horses awaiting slaughter. In 1825, he introduced a second bill to regulate knacker's yards, a bill to prohibit bear baiting, badger baiting, dog fights, a bill to increase the penalty for wanton cruelty to animals, and a bill to make the cutting and wounding of animals a misdemeanor. In 1826, he introduced bills to prohibit bear baiting, amend the 1822 Act again, prevented the cruel treatment of improper treatment of dogs. None of these bills become laws. So this is when he's in his 70s. Amazing tenacity of someone who just kept going. And throughout this time, he was still going into the streets and arresting people and trying to bring prosecutions, which we'll come to in a minute. But he failed in any further attempts to get legislation passed other than the 1822 Act, of which we celebrate the bicentenary this year. So although the Martins Act was limited to the number of species it protected, it was the first legislation of its kind. While it did not fundamentally challenge the concept of animals as property, the law denied people the defense that they could treat animals cruelly because they were their property. Further, the desire to prevent animal cruelty was restricted by as much as a concern for animals as by the social problems, including public order, associated with such working class entertainments as cockfighting. So again, the focus of the legislation attempts were to deal mainly with what the working classes, how they enjoyed themselves and how they made a living. So let's just spend a little time here talking about Martin's Act and its enforcement. From the 1820s until the Metropolitan Police were established in 1829, the responsibility for bringing prosecutions was with individuals, private individuals. Martin understood that if he wanted to see his cruel treatment of cattle act enforced, he would have to draw from his training as a barrister, which he did not practice, and he had to prosecute his own law. On the day after his act received royal assent, Martin entered Smithfield Horse Market and arrested Samuel Clark and David Hyde for beating their respective horses. 3 weeks later, Clark and Hyde appeared in court to find the prosecutor was Martin. Clark and Hyde became the first people to be found guilty of cruelty to animals under the 1822 Act. They were fined 20 shillings each. And Martin's role in this significant achievement was as a lawmaker, arresting officer, prosecutor, and chief witness. With subsequent successful prosecutions, Martin urged the court to impose the minimum fine of 10 shillings, but often pleaded leniency for the offender and paid the fine himself. His motive was to secure prosecutions, publicize the act, and warn against the negative social consequences of animal cruelty, not only for the animals, but also for the perpetrators. Now, one noteworthy case, and I'm sorry if this is a bit of a fuzzy image, was the case when Martin sought to prosecute a Bill Byrne, a costermonger, for mistreating his donkey The story goes that Martin brought the donkey into the court to show his injuries. There's some dispute whether this actually happened or not, but I like to think it did happen. Byrne was found, and you know, this image would not exist unless it actually happened. Let's just go with that. That's good history, isn't it? So Martin brought the donkey into the court to show his injuries. And there is a great book by E.P. Evans on criminal prosecutions of animals. So Byrne was found guilty and paid a fine. And a popular song, If I Had a Donkey, celebrated the prosecution. And these, I'm not going to sing it, but you can see the bullets here. Starting here, it does the lyrics. That's an extract from the lyrics. So you know that Martin made an impact on what we call popular culture at that time, because the song was made of it. Martin realized he could only achieve so much on his own. What was needed was a society or an organization that represented the interests of animals. So now we're going to turn to the second bicentenary, the founding of the RSPCA in 1824. Humphrey Primatt published his book The Duty of Mercy and the Sin of Cruelty to Brute Animals in 1776. Primatt's book is generally recognized as the first systemic theology about animals written from the perspectives of reason and faith. Pain is pain, Primatt wrote, whether it be inflicted on man or on beast, and the creature that suffers it, whether man or beast, being sensible of it while it lasts, suffers evil. The Reverend Arthur Broom published an abridged version of Primatt's book in 1822 with the following dedication: to Richard Martin, Esquire, MP, whose active and unwearied zeal, both in a public and private capacity, in endeavouring to promote a more just and humane treatment of the brute species, bears ample testimony to the benevolence of his heart and presents an example worthy of imitation. These pages are, with cordial respect and esteem, inscribed. So, Old Slaughter's Coffee House. The word slaughter is not to do with the slaughtering of animals, as far as I can ascertain. It's to do with the owner of the coffee house, hence Old Slaughter's Coffee House. And there was several Old Slaughter's Coffee House. The building here does not exist anymore, but the site of it has a blue plaque on it in central London, recording the fact that this is where a meeting took place that led to the foundation of the RSPCA. So Arthur Broom, who published Primatt's book, and the book was included a dedication to Richard Martin, Broom dreamed of an anti-cruelty society, and Martin inspired him to act. Broom convened a meeting at Old Slaughter's Coffee House in London, and a notice about it was published in the magazine John Bull on November the 3rd, 1822. And it recognizes Martin. That the cordial thanks of this meeting are given to Richard Martin, Esquire, MP, to whose praiseworthy and indefatigable exertions in the cause of humanity, the public are indebted for a bill introduced by him into Parliament and passed into law, entitled A Bill for Preventing the Cruel and Improper Treatment of Cattle. Now, no records exist of what, if anything, happened next, but we do know that there was a meeting in 1822. No anti-cruelty society developed immediately after that meeting. But in 1823, so the next year, Broom published a new edition of Primatt's book with the announcement that profits arising from the sale of this tract will be given to the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And what was happening was that the profits from the sale of that book that Broom published paid Broom, gave him the funds to engage privately someone called a Mr. Wheeler to keep an eye upon the men who brought cattle to Smithfield Market. And in 6 months, this guy Wheeler secured conviction of 63 men for animal cruelty under Martin's Act. So Broome entrepreneurially published the book. The proceeds from the book gave him the money to employ Mr. Wheeler to enforce the Act. The SPCA finally came into existence at a meeting again at Old Slaughter's coffee house on June 16th, 1824. So the reason why the SPCA bicentenary is not 1822, when there was a first meeting, is because nothing resulted from that meeting other than what Broome did. But in there was a second meeting in 1824 in June that did result in the meeting convening and organising the SPCA. So on June 16th, 1824, a meeting was chaired by an MP called Fowell Buxton. 21 men were present, including three clergymen and four MPs, one of whom was William Wilberforce, who had spoken out in support of Martin's Act. Wilberforce first advocated for the abolition of the slave trade in 1787, and it was not until 1807 when that law was passed. Buxton also played a prominent role in ending the slave trade. So the point I really want to mention here is that two sides of a coin, in a way. You had men, and I'm sorry to keep saying it's men, but there were no women being recorded being involved at this time. They had, on the one hand, they saw a commonality between cruelty to animals and cruelty involved with the slave trade. But on the other hand, they had a blind moral spot in the sense that they did not question the activities that their clients did when it indulged in field sports and hunting. So Broome resigned his job as Reverend at St. Mary's in Bromley to be appointed as the first honorary secretary of the SPCA. It was decided that the society's mission was the mitigation of animal suffering, the promotion and expansion of the practice of humanity towards the inferior classes of animated beings. Its strategy became, as Mike Radford puts it in his excellent book, Animal Welfare Law in Britain, one of education and enforcement. So from its very beginnings, the strategy that it was pursuing of education and enforcement is the strategy which the society essentially pursues today, and is mimicked by many organisations around the world. At the inaugural meeting in 1824, Martin warned that the society against becoming only a vehicle to prosecute offenders. He wanted it to be more than just that. Like Broome, who had engaged Wheeler as an agent to help with the Martin's Act enforcement, Martin had also employed an agent for the same purpose. So you had both Richard Martin and Arthur Broome, each employing at their own private expense people to prosecute the Martin's Act. Wheeler became the society's first inspector. This is the guy who Broome employed. So he became the first of the society's inspectorate, which the inspectorate continues through to this day, and helped the society successfully prosecute 149 cases of animal cruelty during its first year, and mostly at Smithfield. Again, well, I could cynically say that I don't think the RSPCA, well, let's put it this way, I think the RSPCA could do more to prosecute farm animal abuse today than it could. And I'm bothered by the RSPCA's licensing of animal welfare-based farming practices. So Louis Gompertz, it was therefore resolved by the RSPCA at its inaugural meeting to establish two committees. The first to publish tracts, sermons, and similar modes of influencing public opinion, again, something that we do to this day, and then the second to to adopt measures for inspecting the markets and streets of the metropolis, the slaughterhouses, the conduct of coachmen, etc. So this was the enforcement side of things. So public education and law enforcement. The publications committee included Wilberforce, Arthur Broom, and Louis Gompertz, who became the society's second honorary secretary. The inspections committee included the MPs Buxton and Martin. A total of 11 men served on each committee. Now, the first reference to a woman's involvement in the society that I can find was in 1829, when the minutes of a meeting were referred to a Mrs. Hall and her campaign to end bullfighting. And I'm sorry, sir, I cannot find anything else about that. While information about the first few years is scant, of this first few years of the society's existence, it is known from the records that the society was beset by a lack of funds, prompted in part by demand from its successful track record in prosecutions. So its success was its own worst enemy, if you like. The committee even considered dissolving the society during this time, because I guess it couldn't cope with the demand with the funds it had available. Even though he spent £67 paying off creditors, Arthur Broom, the first secretary, allowed the society to accrue £300 in debts by 1826. So it started off, despite it having a lauded group of people, men, founding the society, it had financial problems from the outset. And because he allowed the society to accrue £300 in debt, he was arrested and jailed because of it. And this is how Gompertz was appointed the second honorary secretary. And Gompertz and Martin raised funds to bail him out, but he didn't bail out Broom. So the funds raised did not pay off the funds that Broom spent on his own, of his own money, but bailed him out of jail. And again, reflecting present-day animal protection organisations in the sense that legacy income is considerably helps a society and underwrite the continuation of its work. So animal groups, the business of animal groups, which is something I know a lot about, a lot of animal groups are able to succeed and survive because of the legacy income that they receive, not necessarily because donations of from people like you and I. Legacy income often saves an organisation from going bankrupt. And that's exactly what happened with the SPCA in its first years. So, reaching toward the conclusion now, for the first few years of its existence from its formation in 1824, the SPCA worked hard to make a difference for animals with limited resources. Organised concern for the welfare of animals was at its formative stage. The society challenged people's lack of compassion for animals and ignorance of animals' ability to suffer, set against the economic expediency of the times that valued animals only as property, only a financial value to the owner. And not that much different from today, to be quite honest with you. Against all odds, the SPCA prevailed through the decades, including receiving royal patronage in 1840, to emerge in the 20th century and post-Second World War, strongly entrenched in the animal welfare tradition of mostly cat and dog rescue. It wasn't until the mid-1970s when progressives on the council, led by Richard Ryder, John Bryant, Celia Hammond, and Lord Houghton, and many others, challenged the society to catch up with the emerging animal rights movement and join them in working for the rights of all animals, a challenge that the society, under the leadership of its present chief executive, Chris Sherwood, continues to focus on to this day. I should add as a footnote that I also did spend time on the RSPCA Council, National Council, in the mid-1980s, but expelled from the society for publicly criticising some financial practices they had at that time. So this brings me to my conclusion. The present day and 200 years from now, when our successors will be celebrating the quadricentenaries of the Martins Act in 2022 and the foundation of the RSPCA in 2024. 200 years from now, 400 years from now, 200 years looking back, they simultaneously feel like very small and very large amounts of time. Either way, the question to ask is this: has very little or very much been accomplished for animals since the 1820s? I suppose it depends on whether you see before us a glass half empty or a glass half full. I see the former. Yes, there is progress to report for animals, but set that against a comparison of the number of animals killed annually today for our purposes and how they are exploited with the status of animals 200 years ago. While how many and how are not the only ways to measure progress in human-animal relations, they are key indicators. I'm not sure if we can ever know how many animals were abused in the 1820s, but we do know something about their treatment. Some cruelties from that time are banned today, but persist elsewhere in the world. But the 1820s and 2020s comparison weighs heavily against the interests of animals. Tens of billions of animals, birds and fish are bred to be exploited and killed today for human consumption. This was not the case in Martin's time. Moreover, in the last 200 years, many species have become extinct because we exploited them. I'm not now so sure it's even a half glass full comparison. Maybe more like an empty glass comparison. So I'm going to end with an uncharacteristically optimistic take, Erica. When I look into the next 200 years and the forthcoming quadricentenaries of the Martins Act in 2022 and the foundation of the RSPCA in 2024, I think, well, I hope they will be celebrating the end of industrial agriculture or factory farming as it's more often known. Why? Because it's unsustainable. It consumes more resources than it produces. It also, like tobacco and alcohol, is a major factor in causing human disease. And I believe we are presently witnessing the growing implosion of intensive industrial agriculture. This is occurring at a time when increasing numbers of people question the food they eat from many perspectives. Venture capitalists are investing funds in companies developing vegan alternatives to food and clothing, while recognizing the limitations of bourgeois market forces of individual optional consumerism. I'm more encouraged by the following reports of governments, including Singapore, Canada, Denmark, Spain, the Netherlands, United States, and the European Union investing in plant-based alternatives to meat, including lab-grown and cultured meats. That gives me hope that when I see governments investing in those enterprises. Individual change is good, but institutional change or government change is better. But the reality check is whether there is enough time for factory farming's demise to occur before the planet's environment rises up against humanity. Nature always bats last, and we humans may not be the last animal left standing 200 years from now. We may not be here to celebrate the quadricentenaries of the Martins Act in 2022 and the foundation of the RSPCA in 2024. We won't be here anyway, because we'll all be long gone, but we can speculate about whether our successors will be here. So I leave you on a somewhat guardedly optimistic remark. Thank you very much.
That's fantastic. Thank you.